Today on The Grave Talks, The Rolling Hills Asylum. Originally referred to as a poorhouse, the Rolling Hills Asylum was home to many. There was little discussion of who would be housed at the Rolling Hills, or could be, or needed to be. The building and grounds would end up being homes for orphaned children, families, destitute elderly, physically handicapped, mentally unstable, morally corrupt, and even criminals. All considered archaic and cruel by modern standards, these institutions were commonplace in the United States and in many parts of the world in the 19th and 20th century. It's easy to understand why there would be so much negative and hostile energy in such a confined space. Rolling Hills Asylum, at that point in time, was considered to be the perfect place for the unwanted. Rolling Hills Asylum was located close enough to populated areas, yet far enough to not have to look at those that society had cast out. Once admitted as what they called an inmate, residents of Rolling Hills Asylum would never leave its grounds. Changes did come to Rolling Hills, though. The property would eventually transition into a beloved nursing care facility. By that time, in the late 1970s, many of its buildings and land had gone into a perpetual change phase. The area would see restaurants, shops, and other businesses housed within the rooms of Rolling Hills Asylum. And it is in this time period where stories of the paranormal began to be reported. Strange noises in the night, a corridor where shadow people would roam freely. And in more recent times, conscious and sometimes humorous comments coming through as investigators try to make contact with the dead while collecting EVPs. For a facility that once held some very negative energy, surprisingly, there seems to be a positive energy emanating from Rolling Hills Asylum these days. On this episode of The Grave Talks, we discuss the current state of affairs with Sharon Coyle, the current caretaker of the facility.
Well, counties around the country in the late 1700s and early 1800s were trying to develop a welfare system of sorts for their mentally and physically disabled and their orphans and their widows and all types of people that needed help. And around 1825, Genesee County started looking out at this area here where I'm at now because we had a bunch of wide open farmland. We're away from all the major towns and other locations where they could ship out all these people and they'd be out of mainstream society. People wouldn't have to look at them, deal with them, and yet they'd be in an area where they could be self-sufficient because they could have their own food source, crops and cattle and so forth. So they built the Genesee County Poorhouse, is what we opened up as in January 1st, 1827. And it housed all those people, including Civil War soldiers and, all types of people. And if you were a widow, an orphan, a drunkard, mentally, physically disabled, anybody that needed help, anybody that was homeless or just needed a leg up or just wanted to be shipped out of mainstream society. I mean, even if you were some criminals were even brought out here, depending on what your crime was. So that's what happened in 1827. And we had all a bunch of dormitories and dining rooms and care rooms and barns and silos and pigsties and chicken coops, and it was really quite something. It was 108 acres of land, and it was all self-sufficient. I mean, there was this one woman, Mary, and, you know, so there was nothing wrong with her mentally, but she had, like, a cleft palate, and she didn't have any cartilage on her ears, and she had, I can't think of what I want to say. She had problems walking with her legs. She had, her feet were turned in, and so she couldn't really stand up and walk very well. But, I mean, there was nothing mentally wrong with her, but there was no place to put her. She was hard to understand when she spoke because, you know, she had the cleft palate and she would spit, you know, so she'd get everybody wet. And she looked different because she didn't have any cartilage on her ears. But there wasn't anything, you know, mentally wrong with her, but people didn't want to deal with people like that, so this was a place to put them.
With literally so many people from different walks of life all intermingled in this one facility, how did they manage it? How did they keep people separate? Did they keep people separate, or how was this handled?
Well, there was a keeper of the house, as they used to call them, or a superintendent or a caretaker. Mainly, they called them the keeper of the house. And there were different ones over the course of the history of the property, of course, because of how long we've been open. But they would manage everybody and oversee all the different departments. And so they would have traveling doctors and nurses come in. They, at the very beginning, when it was a poorhouse, they didn't have staff on for the medical facility, but they would have traveling nurses and doctors come in. There was a head cook. There was someone that was head of the farm animals. There was someone head of the laundry. So they had, you know, several different departments throughout the property, and this keeper would oversee all of them. And everyone was segregated by sex. So you'd have males in one dormitory and females in another dormitory, and not necessarily broken down by age or any other reason, just normally segregated by sex. And everyone that was lived here was referred to as an inmate. It was like a generic term. It was just a label saying the inmates of the poorhouse. And all the inmates had to work the farm. And that was to keep the cost down for the county, so they don't have to hire labor to take care of the farm animals and the crops and the cleaning and so forth. And it also gave these inmates a chance to meet other inmates. You know, if you're working in the kitchen, you're obviously, if you're peeling potatoes, you're going to start talking to the person next to you. So you got to be integrated here and not feel like you were isolated and didn't know anybody. And sometimes you were able to learn a skill. If you were out here because you were down and out on your luck, and there wasn't anything really wrong with you, but maybe you were a drunkard at one point, and now they've got you sobered up, and you know you're a decent person. Maybe you know you have some brains behind you and some craft behind you, and maybe you can learn how to be a blacksmith, or maybe you're going to be really great at woodworking, and you're going to build some furniture. So sometimes it wasn't a bad thing to come out here. It really gave people a leg up.
How did someone end up finding themselves confined to this location?
Again, a variety of reasons. It could have been that you were a drunkard in the sheriff's office, because seeing you, you know, stumble all over town causing a ruckus. You could have been a widow. Your husband could have died in the war or in a farming accident. And, you know, back in the early days, women weren't allowed to own property on their own. And so the county would come over and take your land away from you. And if you had no family to help you and your children out, they would tell you to pack a bag and we'll bring you down to the poorhouse. You're going to live down there for a while. And so it was really a variety of reasons, health reasons. You know, if you were mentally unstable and you were acting out, you were probably brought down here. Orphans were brought down here. The orphans didn't always stay here, though. Oftentimes, if you had a farmer that lost his wife in childbirth and he's got two little kids and a brand new baby and an 80-acre farm, he can't do all that work himself. He can't take care of the baby and the children and the farm. So he would come down here and pick up two young children, a boy and a girl, to go home with him. And the boy would help, you know, do the chores around the farm, and the little girl would take care of the baby and the other children who were probably not much older than her. And so sometimes the orphans were just pulled out of here.
Other than the situation of the orphans, the adults that were admitted to the facility, what sort of say did they ever have in their choice in leaving?
You know, I really think it just depends on how well they improved and if they had a way to care for themselves. Obviously, if they sobered up and they still had no way of making an income and taking care of themselves, they're not going to be able to leave here because they're just going to be a problem. They could go into crime, robbing, things of that sort. So they had to prove that they were able to be self-sufficient on their own.
In terms of the timeline of the facility, how long was it considered what they called a poorhouse?
Well, we opened up in 1827, and the next change out here didn't happen until the 1930s. 1938, to be specific, we ended up having an infirmary built out here, an actual hospital, the Genesee County Infirmary. So not until like the 30s or the 40s, even into the 50s, it really started to wane down. The land got divided up, and eventually in the 60s, we became a nursing home. So it went on for quite a lot of years.
What was the reason where in time it eventually transitioned and turned into a nursing care facility?
It was a need out here, and I believe by then there was welfare systems and a lot of other government programs that were helping the poor and the needy and the mentally unstable out, and the orphans. I know that there were orphanages that were beginning to be built in the early 1900s. There was dedicated mental asylums for people rather than just all being a hodgepodge poorhouse. I believe Willard was one of the ones locally that opened up, and they took a lot of the mentally unstable people. Of course, prisons were growing, and so a lot of the more criminally insane people went into the prison system. So there were a lot of different government issues that changed in society at that point.
Once it became the nursing care facility, did any stories come out of that period in the life of the building relating to the paranormal?
Well, I mean, there were always different things happening out here. I mean, just like in any facility that you're going to have where you're housing a bunch of different people and different mentalities and different issues. I mean, there were inmates that would strangle each other out in the middle of the night. They were fighting. I mean, it's just the nature of the facilities that occurred back then. But then there were great things. I met a gentleman not too long ago that he worked out here when it was a nursing home, but his great-grandparents actually were here during the poorhouse years. They came here individually for whatever reason, and they met here, and they got married and left. And that's how his family became in existence today, because they met out here. So not everyone that came out here was in dire need. I mean, some people were brought out here like Roy. Roy was he's our 7.5-foot shadow man. And he was brought out here when he was 12 years old. There was nothing mentally wrong with him at all. He was just oversized. He had gigantism, and so he was, you know, 7 feet tall by the time he was 12, and his father didn't care for him and felt that he was an embarrassment to his family and dropped him off out here and left him out here his whole life. And there was nothing wrong with him. He was very, very intelligent, very capable person, but he just looked different. And being that big in society at that time, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, people are going to look at you and stare at you, and there's no real compassion for you. I mean, you have to have everything made for you specifically. I mean, can you imagine holding a fork in your hand and you're 7.5 feet tall or 7 feet tall when he was first here? I mean, his hands had to have been 12 inches long, at least. You know, so a fork is going to be the size of a toothpick pretty much in your hand. So everything had to be made. And, I mean, I can't even imagine what he did for a porta potty. I mean, honestly, I mean, or when they did have bathrooms, not to be, you know, going down that line of thought, but I mean, a 7-foot man on a standard toilet is going to be pretty awkward.
Quite a dramatic change from what I understand of life when it was a poorhouse to a nursing care facility in the 1960s. Just how different was life there once that transition had occurred?
Sure. The nursing home in the 60s, from what I understand, the residents loved it here. I mean, you have to remember we're still wide open fields. Some of the land had been divided, and adjacent to us was created the Genesee County Park. So there's trees here, there's wide open fields, there's deer coming through, there's bunnies coming through. So they're able to sit outside and have flower gardens and things of that sort. I've met many people that when they were children would come here and visit the elderly at the nursing home and come and put on plays for them, like whether it was the Girl Scouts, or they would come in and do bell choirs or help them with arts and crafts. So, I mean, they really loved it here. And from what I understand, when it closed down in 74 and they shipped everyone over to Batavia to the new facility, I mean, many of them cried and cried and cried. They really didn't want to leave here. They enjoyed it when it was the nursing home quite a bit.
Also at that time, rumblings would flare up regarding unexplained occurrences, correct?
Well, it's really funny, and I really think it has a lot to do with the era and the mentality of people and just what was acceptable to talk about, because I have met many people actually, that had something to do with the nursing home, whether they worked here, had relatives here, visited here, was a vendor dropping off, you know, supplies here. And, you know, most people have said, oh, I didn't know it was haunted. But you know what? You have to remember, too, back in the day, people didn't talk about stuff that they couldn't explain because people would deem you crazy. You know, they didn't want to talk about stuff like that. Or they were so heavily into religion that it was blasphemy to talk about stuff like that. You know, so a lot of people swept it under the rug. Being involved in the paranormal for so long, ghosts didn't just appear, you know, 15 years ago or so when Jason and Grant, you know, first started their TV show. They didn't just all of a sudden, oh my God, there are ghosts in the world, you know? There's been paranormal activity forever. People have been dying for, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years. So to think that all of a sudden activity just popped up, out of the blue, I think that's kind of ridiculous. I just think that it's what's become fashionable. I mean, you couldn't, today you could go in anywhere and have a conversation, sitting down at dinner, talk about sex and politics. Back then, you know, and let's talk, you know, paranormal. You know, it wasn't always acceptable to sit down and talk about things like that.
After the life of the nursing facility ended, what were the next incarnations of the facility?
Well, it closed down in 74, and then it sat empty for quite a long time, about 10 years. And then there were three private owners prior to me, and they all had different agendas. The first owner wanted to stay assisted living, almost like little apartments, and have traveling doctors and nurses come in and check on people, have a little store, you know, kind of like how apartment complexes are now. So he's kind of very forward-thinking. He wanted, like, all condensed, one-stop place for elderly people that didn't need to be in a nursing home, but really just shouldn't be living in a big home by themselves. And he had some struggles. He didn't have a lot of money, and he tried to do the best he could, but it didn't succeed at all. He didn't even get very far. And after about 10 years, he passed away, and then the owner after them opened up what was called Rolling Hills Country Mall. And as a matter of fact, I just had someone come through on my tour the other day, and they had been here when it was the Country Mall. And at that point, they were having a restaurant in here. They had a bakery and shops and all kinds of things going on. And this one woman was saying, oh, I remember going into the bakery, and it was really creepy. We'd go and we'd buy cookies and muffins, and it was really, really creepy. And I said, well, I know where it is. I said, when we get down there, I'll ask you if you think this is where the bakery is, but I won't tell you what it is until we walk in there. And sure enough, it's our morgue, which is what I knew where it was. Our morgue later on in life became a bakery, and they used the coolers to put in you know, all the eggs and the butter and the perishables and the cheesecakes and things like that. But in the day, it was the morgue, and they would use those coolers for the bodies that needed to be stored there while they were prepping them for burial or for pickup. So that kind of skeeved her out. But she was, I knew it was made me feel weird down here. So, yeah, so, I mean, and so that was like the Bodeckers when they had Carriage Village. And then after they left about 10 years, and we're up to the year 2000, and it was a country mall, antiques mall, and a craft mall. And around 2004 is when that owner was really paying attention to all the weird activity. And that's how it became known to be active paranormally.
What was the first story that you ever heard personally about paranormal activity on the property?
I bought the property, and it wasn't from the owner. It was from a bank. It was an auction. And so, you know, I'm kind of limited on firsthand accounts unless people come through here and tell me things. And I have had people come through that when it was Carriage Village that they would say, oh, I didn't like going in there, and I swore I saw somebody. Or even the old tenants that had shops here saying, oh, I heard things in the building, and, you know, I saw this and I saw that. But, you know, do they have pictures and stuff for documentation? No, because they were poo-pooing it off as, oh, they're in an old building and it's creeping me out kind of thing, you know? Well, I mean, I came here in 2008 on a ghost hunt with Jason and Grant, so that's where I heard a lot of the stories that have been handed down. I'm trying to think specifically if I can name somebody specifically that told me something. And I don't know if I have a name off the top of my head. But, I mean, literally, it's just people saying that they, you know, they saw a white figure walking around and there shouldn't have been anybody around. Or they were hearing, you know, kids giggling and running up and down the halls, and there wasn't anybody in the building except for, you know, the storekeeper setting up their stores, you know. So, I mean, I guess it would have been as far back as the Bodeckers then. That would have been around the 90s. That's when I started hearing from people that were there during the 90s. You know, I don't know anybody that actually was in here when Cecil was here. My neighbor knew him, but never really came in the building at that point. Actually, I'm gonna retract what I just said. I think Cecil, back in the 80s when he bought the property, I think he actually was experienced a lot of paranormal activity. I'll tell you why. He was known, and my neighbor knew him, and I met some EMTs that met him. He was known for running around in the building with a shotgun in one hand and a machete in the other, and he was afraid of the break-ins. But in retrospect, I think it was more than just people breaking in there at that point that he was afraid of. Because think about this for a minute. You know, you need two hands to use a shotgun. You really do. You got to crank the, you know, cock the barrel and pull the trigger, and you got to hold it in two hands. So running around with a shotgun in one hand and a machete in the other, that's pretty heavily armed. I think that living in that building for so long by himself, day in and day out, he had activity in there. And he may have thought he was hearing people breaking in and hearing people running around and seeing people. And I wouldn't be surprised if he actually was experiencing a lot of heavy paranormal activity and seeing things. Just like, think about The Shining with Jack Nicholson, how he kind of was hallucinating. He was seeing the bartender behind the bar and you know, things of that sort. I think he was experiencing stuff like that. So I think it went back, as far as I can trace, at least until when Cecil was there. I'm not going to necessarily say the nursing home years, only for the fact is that I haven't talk to any of the patients there. They're all gone. They're all dead. So,
what was the driving force behind you wanting to take possession of this building and buy it?
I don't know to this day, to be honest with you. I had a meltdown. I came here in 2008, had a great time, had incredible three nights of activity, full body apparitions, awesome full body photos of spirits, Roy specifically, as well as some others, amazing EVPs. And, you know, I was happy living in California, a mile from the beach. You know, I had a team out there that we did home investigations. I had a big group, meetup group of 250 people. We would do all the historical places like Queen Mary and the Hornet and stuff like that. And never thought I'd ever leave California. I was very happy there. And then I got a phone call that this place was closing down. And they didn't know what was going to happen to it, whether it was going to be destroyed and bulldozed down, or what. I mean, and I literally had a meltdown on the phone. Like, I started bawling, like, oh my God. I mean, I was really brokenhearted and distraught. And I don't know why this place touched me so much. I really, truly don't. To this day, I remember the reaction I had. I remember all the stuff that I've gone through to get that property. It was a force beyond me, and I know that sounds ridiculous because everyone has free will, but it was truly a force beyond me, and I don't know how else to explain it, but I was supposed to be here, and I was supposed to be here. I don't know why. It's not an easy life. It is not an easy life living here.
What's interesting about your story, because so many stories, it's a property that someone investigates, or it's a property that someone owns, but they just visit, or they rent it out for investigations and such. You physically live at this property, correct?
I live in the old barn that used to be the old woodworking shop where they made furniture and caskets, and a couple of private owners who lived in here, and it isn't modernized at all. I'm looking at my staircase right now. It is literally slats of wood to create a staircase. It's not even a staircase. It's literally a barn staircase, like you would go up in a barn. I have plywood floors, no kitchen cabinets. I mean, it's not a good place to live, but it is where I live.
When you first took possession, walked through those doors, and it was yours, what was it like?
I was on autopilot, to be honest with you. I got here and I, you know, got off the airplane with one suitcase and kept running ever since. I'm still running. I'm still running like crazy. I got here and, you know, when you first looked at the property, when I first saw it at night as an investigator, you know, of course it's pitch black and, you know, you're hepped up and all amped up looking for and hoping to find paranormal activity. So you don't look at the building itself and what's going on in the building, really, as far as from an owner point of view. And when you come back and you look at to buy it, you see all the flaws and the mess. And when you get here, you're like, oh my God, what am I going to do? It was 11 and a half acres, 60,000 square feet. You know, was originally about 100 rooms, probably 80 rooms now, meaning that some of the rooms got opened up, so they're not as many small rooms anymore. But every room was piled sky high with stuff. Everything from leftover items from the different shops to Girl Scout cookies and Joe Peeps eaten through by rats because they were storing them in there. It was bags of dirty underwear and clothing and books and hodgepodge of stuff in every single solitary room, every room, and hallways. and it was a disaster. It's like everyone that had ever come through here had just said, let me bring my stuff up that's left over from my garage and basement. I'm just going to dump it in there, you know, instead of bringing it to the dump. And it was a mess. So my first thought was, I really need to get it cleaned up. I need to get it organized. I need to get keep what I can keep, what is useful and can be reused in some purpose. And stuff that's really garbage has to go out. And anything that isn't useful to me or garbage that is, you know, worth donating, I can donate or get rid of it some other fashion. I had to make hide or hair out of the whole thing.
What was the goal when you were beginning the cleanup process and going through everything at the end of the game here, at the end of getting through all of those chores? What was your goal? What is the goal of the building and the property?
Oh, well, I mean, it was always the same. I mean, you know, you ghost hunt some paranormal investigations here. I really want to make it a full-on research lab, which is really, for me, it's hard to get going on that. I do have a room dedicated to that right now. And I'm trying to get some other equipment in there for that so I can actually have a dedicated research center. But it was to do paranormal investigations, to do historical tours, to open up the museum. We do historical tours now. And do other events out here to bring in the public. It used to be a community facility. I mean, everything from the nursing home and the poorhouse years to when the Bodeckers were here and having powwows, to on the Native Americans and all kinds of, you know, the shops and everything. So I wanted to bring other people back in here, not just people that are interested in the paranormal. So that's why I do movie nights. I do catered dinners with a ghost. We do paint nights and other activities out here to bring in other people that you know, want to see historical property, want to hear about the history, but have no interest in the paranormal. So I don't want to eliminate all those people. So that's why I'm trying to do other events out here. And that's what my goal was in the beginning, and still is.
How about the activity when you were there? Some of the first occurrences that really stood out to you, what were they?
Oh, gosh. I mean, of course, I had activity when I was here on the visit in 2008. But the very first day after I bought the property, I left the courthouse, and I came down here. And I went in the building, and I went in with a couple other people because, you know, you should never go in a building by yourself. And I had a recorder going, and it was immediate EVPs, and they were commenting on me, and they were making fun of me. And I can remember I went in one room, and all of a sudden this woman is talking, and she's like in a half whisper, and she's like she's answering someone who came up to her. And all I can envision is like someone came up to her and like pointed at me and looked at her, and she goes, "She's the new owner." So it was pretty cool. It's pretty cool. They knew who I was right away. And it was great getting those EVPs. I was in the morgue, and in the morgue, they had a pizza oven. And from when it was the bakery, and I remember on the recorder the day, I went in there and went, "Oh my God, they left the pizza oven." And some man goes, "Who cares?" You know, it was hilarious. Literally, they were just commenting on everything I was saying, you know. It was just hilarious. I still have the recording of it all and stuff. But, you know, whenever that woman said she's the owner and that guy was saying, "Who cares?" and all these other little comments about me and what was going on, they all came out of the woodwork to see me, and it was kind of fun. And I'll never forget that. And they've been like that ever since. They're always in there. They're always commenting on things. I know you want to ask a question, but I'm going to go off on this tangent for a minute. I can remember a couple of years back, I was in what we call our green room. It's where everyone comes in and has coffee and fills out paperwork in our shop and stuff. And I was in there by myself, and people were off on a ghost hunt. And I was changing the battery lights, the batteries and the lights in the display cases. And I was, you know, had a recorder going, and of course you're tagging everything, and oh, Sharon opening up the batteries, and you know, blah blah blah, and this and that. I'm doing this and doing that, so you know you're making your noises. And I was having trouble with, you know, I got one light to work, and I was having trouble with the other light, and I finally realized I had the batteries in backwards, so I flipped them around, it worked fine. I play back the recorder, and you can hear me saying, "Gosh, I don't know why this one isn't working." And this old man goes, "Turn them around the other way." So he was trying to help me. So I love them. I mean, they're just so awesome in there. They're now. They're cognizant, they're aware, and they're now.
When someone asks you specifically about the personalities, the people, the spirits that are there, what do you tell them?
Oh, I mean, there are so many of them. I mean, I can give you, volumes of them on my own without even retelling any of the attendees. And if I start getting into the visitors and the investigators here, it's just quadrupled. I mean, it's everything from, literally seeing people walk away from us, like humans, walking down Shadow Hallway and going down the hallway and up into the infirmary to, follow a noise that they heard. And we're all sitting back in the hallway watching them, and there's no one else in the building except for our group. And then we see other people walk by and come down the stairs and come down the ramp at us, and we're thinking it's the human people that walked up there, and it's not. Then this full-on human, dark shadow, which we thought were these two guys, walk towards us, and they turn right, and they go down the ramp and disappear. And then all of a sudden, the two guys that went up there originally come walking down the stairs saying, yeah, we couldn't find anything. And we're like, oh my God, you just missed it. They were right there. Or being pushed in the wheelchair, or, hearing the screaming lady who sounds like she's beaten, bloody, stabbed to death. Getting a photo last August 5th, my dog passed away that I had for 14 years, broke my heart, still breaks my heart every day. And I went in and I had a full on, 40 people hunt, and I didn't want to be there because I'm warning my dog. And I told everyone, if you get a picture of my dog or an EVP, let me know. And sure enough, they got a picture of my dog that night up in Shadow Hallway that I have. Hearing my mother, who died in 2001, holler for me and not anyone know about it. And then I had a medium come in a week later and told me that she was standing in front of her and said she didn't mean to scare me when she hollered for me, but she's going to holler for me again. Just crazy stuff like that. Doors opening and closing. Going in there when I first got there and being scared to death, like, how am I going to make a go of this? How am I going to pay, the electric bill this month? And going in there and begging them to help me, bring me in, visitors, or, bring me a film shoot, or, something. And then rounding a corner into a room that I just cleaned out and finding an envelope of pennies and dimes in there that are sitting in the middle of the floor that wasn't there before. Crazy stuff like that. I mean, it's a very special place. I'm going to cry because when I sit up and I really think about it and I start talking about it again, it's amazing. I mean, there's some creepy stuff that happens. I'm not going to lie. There was one time, oh my God, I thought someone had broke into the building. And it was a couple days before Christmas. And I was sitting up in the first floor hallway, right by the volunteer entrance, and, had a recorder going, and I'm thanking them for a very good year and excited about the possibilities for next year and, saying them, a couple Christmas carols that nobody wants to hear me sing. That sounds terrible. And all of a sudden above me, it's like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm hearing this banging on the floor. It was coming from Shadow Hallway from the solarium, which is totally like 100 feet down the hallway above me. And it was coming louder and hitting on the floor in rhythmic motion, and it's getting louder and louder above my head. It sounded like a guy with a sledgehammer hitting the floor. And I thought, oh my God, somebody broke in here and they're going to kill me and no one's going to find me for like 2 weeks, So I kind of walked down the stairs, acted like I didn't suspect anything, and talking all the while to the recorder, like, oh, I got to go make some cookies. I'll talk to you later. I'll be back in, blah, blah, blah. And, locking up the door and left. And I called a friend of mine who was a volunteer here, and he was also a federal marshal. He said, Jason, I think somebody broke in the building. Can you please come on? I'm scared to death. I don't want to go back in the building. So he did, and I called my other friend, Julie, who was a volunteer and who was dating Jason. And she happened to be a nurse. So when she got here, she goes, let me hear it before we go in. She goes, it sounds like a guy with a peg leg going down the hall. I'm like, yeah, I know. It's scary. It sounds like a sledgehammer. So anyways, we have three of us go in the building, and Jason looks through every place, No broken windows, no doors ajar, nothing going on. We go up to the shadow hallway, the room right above where I was sitting. There's a hospital room, and there are two crutches always leaning against the doorway when you first walk in on the right. Well, they weren't on the doorway. One of them was standing up, the other one was in the middle of the floor. Jason picks it up and hits the bottom of the crutch on the floor, because it has a rubber stopper, and that was the sound it was. It sounded like this guy was running down the hallway using one of the crutches, and it was right above my head. I literally thought, and I have it on the recorder, that was probably the most scared I've been in the building. I know it sounds stupid, but I really thought somebody had broken in. Somebody was running down that hallway with that crutch, and I thought I was going to be dead. It was scary.
You have to wonder how much he was hearing something like that, too.
Well, exactly. And there was this one room over in the infirmary area where he was making what we call a hidey hole. he was trying to make a false wall in this room where he could hide in at night and, like, you know, pull in a couple of cinder blocks so it looks like it was just a wall so he could hide in there when he was hearing noises and thought that people were in the building. So, I mean, I really think Cecil had a lot of issues with it. And again, just because people didn't talk about it, I think paranormal activity went back pretty far. I mean, we have people that we communicate with, excuse me, from the 1800s and so. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that, I mean, people were there all the time. Spirits were happening all the time. So it just wasn't fashionable to talk about it. I mean, even in my own personal life, I remember my mother telling me at one of our the family homes that my grandmother used to experience things. And she's, excuse me, old world German. And she was terrified. And she would write these things in the Bible while she was praying about what she saw because she thought it was something evil. You know, and I don't think it was necessarily evil. I just think she was experiencing paranormal activity.
Tell me more about Shadow Hall. How did it come to have that name?
It was called that when I got here, which is kind of interesting to me because you see shadows everywhere in that building as far as shadow people. But it's a really good area to sit down and look at it. It seems to have a good flow, just the way it's the top floor of the east wing. And so there's a long span that you can see all the way clearly from one end of the hall all the way through to the infirmary. And so just with the ambient light, it makes it easier to see the shadow people walking in and out of doorways and coming from the infirmary. So it's a long span. But you see shadow people everywhere. And honestly, my favorite hallway is becoming the first floor east wing. So much is happening down there. It's crazy. Items are being thrown at people and materializing out of thin air. Some guy had this euro, a 20 euro, hit him on the back of the head, a seashell that's shaped like a little, kind of like a little cone, came out of nowhere. Like one of his friends was walking behind him and said he saw it fall from the ceiling and hit this guy in the head. Disembodied voices down there. Of a man, and we actually see him walking back and forth into the solarium. There's a boy that we've just discovered that wants ice cream, but can't eat it because he's naked, and he thinks it's terrible that he's naked. And just a lot of stuff, pens being thrown at people in that hallway and in rooms in that hallway. Activity tends to, I don't want to say ebb and flow, but it does morph and change.
Naturally, when you're cohabitating with ghosts and spirits and it's relatively peaceful, I would think you may develop certain affinities towards certain spirits. Do you have a certain favorite ghost that resides there with you?
Well, it's got to be Roy. I mean, you know, Roy's my guy. He's the 7.5-foot shadow man who came here when he was 12. He passed away in 1942 at the age of 52. And I always just felt like he had my back. I don't know why. One night when I was in there, and I was in there with Gary Gelka, who invented the millimeter and some other equipment, and he was in there with me, and we were using his RTVP machine, the real-time recorder, where you can actually hear them respond in real time. And Gary had me walk down the hallway past Roy's room and see if I could talk to Roy. Well, he stayed in the solarium, and I could feel Roy around me, and I heard him talking, but I couldn't hear him clearly. And at one point I said, "Can you say a little something for me?" And he goes, "A little something." And which he was being kind of funny. And then it was winter and I had a heavy winter coat on, and he started to pick up my coat, my arm. And I could feel my arm being like literally lifted up beside my body. And I realized what he was doing. He was trying to do what a gentleman would do when you walk near a woman, you pick up her arm and you put your arm in her arm to walk with her. He was trying to walk with me. And so he had to lift up my arm because he's 7.5 feet tall and 5'2". There's a big difference right there. So he was trying to lift up my arm and walk with me. And he's just a very good soul. He's a good person. He's got a big heart. And I think he just kind of keeps the darker or the harsher spirits at bay, you know, and make sure things stay calm in that building. I mean, I know one of the previous owners had a lot of problems being in the building by herself. from what I understand. She wouldn't be in the building by herself. She wouldn't walk out by herself. She wouldn't open up doors by herself. And she was scared. She was scared of being in the building. And overall, I have no problem going in the building by myself. I'm in there a lot by myself, doing work or locking up or doing chores or whatever the case may be. And I think I have the peace of mind knowing that Roy is there and that that I'm not going to get, you know, no one's going to jump out and, like, scare the bejesus out of me because Roy's going to, you know, clonk him one or something. You know, basically, I just think Roy's got my back. So,
is there anything there that you would consider darker or things that you would avoid interacting with?
Darker is kind of, I should have really used the word darker. There are people, there are good people and bad people everywhere in this world, you know, in your family, in, you know, at work, at the mall, you know, clearly everywhere. So we do have some spirits that aren't so pleasant. There's this one, his name is Steve, and we discovered him quite a few years ago, and he's upstairs in the infirmary, and he really is just an angry person. And really doesn't like anybody, especially men, authoritative figures, or people in the medical field, pharmacists, EMTs, you know, nurses, that sort of stuff. He'll make you really sick to your stomach, or he'll give you pain in your head. And but he likes one of my volunteers. One of my volunteers, Samantha, she actually works with autistic children. And she's young. She's in her, you know, 24 or so. And he has taken a shine to her. Well, she'll use dancing rods up there. And if you try to go near her, get up out of your seat or go near her or to walk by her to go out to the door, the dancing rods flip around and, like, he's protecting her and won't let you near her. Like, they stick out. And it doesn't happen anywhere else except when he's around. Otherwise, you're fine. But he's very protective of her. But he's probably the worst. I mean, there's others that, I mean, they just say nasty things, but you have to remember, people are mentally unstable there. You have people with Tourette's and different mental issues, and a lot of people just don't want to be bothered, you know? They just don't want to be bothered. They'll tell you to get out, or they'll call you a name, and it's just random people. But, you know, you have to remember, you're in a facility that's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. There's a lot of people that came through those doors, and even before that, Native American land, so... You know, you just got a lot of people that just don't want to be bothered.
It's a very good way of describing it. I think quite often the term demonic gets thrown around when something remotely negative is felt. But just as in life, there's people that don't want to be bothered that may be negative. They're not demonic. I would think in death, if they are also still there, they're still a bit of a negative force, but not on the dark demonic scale of things.
Well, and I have a very strong opinion about the word demon and demonic, honestly. You know, before the shows became fashionable, right, all the paranormal stuff, how often did anyone really hear about demons? Not very often. Ever. Hardly. You know, you could probably count it on, you know, a couple of hands, maybe, if you're lucky, over the course of a lifetime. You very rarely heard about demons and demonic activity. I think it's just like, I just think there are people that are unstable and have different levels of anger and are different levels of hostility. I really don't think that the demons are as prevalent as people think. I think that they're labeling activity that which shouldn't be labeled as such. That's my personal opinion. I mean, honestly, and I've been in the film business for years. I started out in the film business working in, you know, commercial production for commercials, doing location management, you know, wardrobe, eventually going into, you know, associate producing on some projects, you know, so I have a long background in the film industry. And, you know, I love the film show, the paranormal shows. They've been very good to me in Rolling Hills. I have nothing negative to say about them, but people have to realize it's television, it's reality television, and television has to sell advertising for those shows to stay on TV. They have to make money. And how do you make money? Well, you want to draw an audience. And, you know, who's going to watch day after day Happy Puppies? Well, I will, because I'm a soft and fuzzy person, really. You know, but, you know, how often are you going to, you know, if you have a choice of watching Happy Puppies or Trainwreck, you're going to watch the Trainwreck, which is awful to say. But, you know, living in California, one of the most popular things to watch are those car chases on TV, the helicopters. I mean, people want to watch that stuff. It's awful. And so, you know, to build up the negative activity in such a way where it's going to draw more people, do I think some of it's exaggerated on television? I do. And I'm, you know, I'm not trying to bash anybody who's on television. As I said, I've known a lot of the people for very many years, even before I bought Rolling Hills, and the shows, you know, have been very good to me. But I do know the reality of television as far as, you know, what needs to occur. I think that if they focused in on, you know, Roy wishing me happy birthday, or, you know, Steve, you know, punching a guy in the gut and giving him a stomach ache, they're going to talk about Steve punching a guy in the gut, giving him a stomach ache.
Obviously, this place has had a very storied history far before you took it over. You are now writing the current chapter of its book. Where do you want to see it in the future? What do you want its future chapters to be long after yours is completed?
I hope it's still standing long before I'm gone. I really want to rehab the property in such a way where I can get all the windows in the West Wing reglazed, you know, make sure I've got every single roof completely redone. I mean, it's a big property. I mean, I've been working on the roofs for a while, and I haven't started the windows yet. I mean, it's going to be a process. I'm trying to get pricing on them, whether I have to eventually replace them all with new windows, which I hate to do, or if I can get funding enough to get the original iron ones taken out and sandblasted and, you know, new windows put in. I don't know what's going to happen. It's a big project. I'd like it to be a living museum. I'd like to, you know, see one of the old dorms rebuilt out here so people could see what it looked like. And maybe rebuild one of the barns out here and try to get it active as you know, what it once was, and get a feel for what it once was, like a living museum. And then have other things, as I said, out here. You know, bam. Maybe have an inn out here where people can stay here. You know, and eat here without having to have a catered dinner. Maybe have a real restaurant out here. I don't know. But I, you know, obviously the paranormal will always be a big, big part of it. But to stay relevant and to stay financially solvent, I have to do other things out here. Paranormal isn't going to pay the bills. Paranormal is going to keep this place going and growing and improving. It's a very costly property. And so I have to start bringing other things, which is what I'm trying to do. And that's the biggest thing, is to keep it going and focus it on the history and have people remember who lived here and why it was here. And the people that we're talking to, yeah, it's very cool to go down and get an EVP and get a cool picture of someone standing in the hallway. But that's someone that lived here, and they had a life, and they had a family, and they had health issues or not. And, you know, they left a mark on their world and their family. And people need to know that. I mean, I often tell people that come through here on tours, especially if they're from Western New York and their parents and grandparents have deep roots here, that when they're walking through the halls, think about it. You could be talking to your long-lost cousin or, you know, distant great-great-grand uncle or aunt. I mean, they literally have relatives that probably lived here, worked here, was a vendor here, or came to visit someone here, you know, and people need to remember that there were people and they're someone's family.
To find out more about the Rolling Hills Asylum, you can visit their webpage, rollinghillsasylum.com. The link is also on our page, thegravetalks.com. Thank you to Sharon for joining us today for the conversation on The Grave Talks. That's going to wrap up today's episode of The Grave Talks. If you like our program, I always say, please press subscribe, share the show, let your friends know we exist, leave us some positive reviews on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you may be listening to us on. That is what helps us grow the show and lets other people know that we exist. Thank you in advance for doing just that. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening.